Welcome to the Women in STEM podcast that focuses on the intersectionality of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. We focus on how we can amplify the voices of women in STEM and make them aware of the multiple different career opportunities that are available. Welcome to the Women in STEM podcast. Would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Hi, I'm Christina LeBlanc. I'm an author for the BCS and I've also worked in tech for over 20 years.
Wow, sounds like you've had a quite an interesting journey for you to be in tech for 20 years. Can you share a part of your journey and how the field has changed and with regards to why you decided to pursue your current path?
Yeah, so I never meant to work in tech. I studied physics and astrophysics at university, and I knew that I wanted to work in the public sector, but I didn't particularly think that I wanted to work in IT. And it just happened that the first job that I was offered was working for a local authority, and it was an IT project role. And it was a great role because it gave me the opportunity to do so many different roles in tech. I was doing help desk support, training, data migration, procurement. It was a small team, so I really got to do everything. And I've spent my whole career since then working in different tech roles, delivering different projects.
And with regards to some of the projects that you've worked on, could you highlight us one of the projects that you've worked on and some of the key impacts that it's had?
So one of my career was when I worked for the NHS. I worked in the NHS for 12 years. And one of those projects was about essentially the economy that exists within the NHS, where providers of care and commissioners of care, where the money has to move around the system. So it was calculating how much activity, how much care had been delivered by different care providers in the NHS and who needed to pay for that, kind of based on where people lived. It was doing calculations of up to about £30 billion, which was a really significant chunk of the NHS budget at that time. And the system was developed in parallel to the policies and processes being developed by the Department of Health. So we really didn't have very much time to make sure that the system reflected what the policies intended. So we had to work very closely with people creating policy, and also with the system developers to make sure that the calculations were exactly correct, because it was such high stakes. I feel really proud of that project. There was a lot of really great people working on that project. And with such high volumes of transactions, it was one of the biggest databases in Europe at the time. And I knew that it brought real value to the NHS as well in what we were delivering.
Speaking of bringing value and analytics, you have a book called Delivering Business Analytics, the BA Service Handbook, which offers a practical guide for BA leaders. What motivated you to write this book, and what was the key takeaways for aspiring business analytics?
So it's business analysis, which is actually different to business analytics, although there's a lot of confusion and a lot of people mix up those terms. Analytics tends to be more about data, processing data, and generating insights through management information. Business analysis is a more holistic technology as well as data. And sometimes it's not about technology at all. Sometimes it's about process improvement. And there's a lot of great books around how to do good business analysis. And my co-author, Dr. Deborah Paul, has written several of them. But there was very few books around which took business analysis to the next step and that was aimed at business analysis leaders and aspiring leaders. And what that book did, Delivering Business Analysis, it talked about business analysis as a service and how we can elevate what we do to be a really effective service within our organisations. So it looked at things like recruitment pipelines, recruitment strategies, tooling strategies, understanding your customers, and thinking about how business analysis can be best delivered within an organisation so that the amount of money that an organisation is spending on business analysis is translating to clear results in the projects, programmes and products that that organisation is creating and delivering.
Congratulations on recently completing your MSc in senior leadership. How do you define effective leadership in the tech industry? And what qualities do you believe are essential for leading a successful digital team?
So in general, this is a bit of a generalization, but in general, the quality of leadership in tech is quite poor because the people who kind of float to the top as kind of being leaders are typically the people who are good technically at whatever the professional discipline is. So whether that's business analysis or software development, if you're a good one, you end up a leader, a lead practitioner, and then a team leader, and then a head of. But that doesn't necessarily translate to having good management and leadership skills. And we're very poor in tech, often in investing in our leaders. We say, okay, well, you're a good software developer, you're a good business analyst, so therefore you're going to make a good team leader. And we don't give people the training, support, and development in this entirely different professional discipline of leadership. And I've been in leadership and management positions for about 10 years before I had any leadership or development training whatsoever. And after the first leadership development course that I did, it was a real snowball effect for me. I ended up doing various different training and development, which ultimately led to me doing the MSc in senior leadership, which I think has been really important for me personally, but it also helped me to understand some of the limitations in technology leadership. We do tend to be very process and technology focused, and the way things actually get done is through people, supporting them and getting the best out of people. And tech leaders aren't always people focused leaders. So that's a real issue in the tech sector. But I do think that leaders, whatever role you're in and whatever sector you're in, if you've never done any leadership development training, don't assume that you are the best leader that you can be. With training and development, we can get better at anything, and leadership is certainly one of those things.
A term that is often not utilized quite a lot is the digital skill gap. So I was wondering if you could kind of explain to the listeners what a digital skill gap is and what are some of the initiatives or strategies that you are currently working on.
So the digital skills gap is a massive issue for the UK. It's actually a global issue, but in the UK, it's costing our economy about £63 billion a year. And that's a calculation done by central government when they formed their digital strategy a few years ago. So it's a big problem. And it's two things. It's the fact that we don't have enough digital skills in the UK to meet the demand and keep up with the level of innovation that we need to remain competitive. People just don't have the skills. And digital skills are made up of different layers. The first being really more kind of digital literacy, understanding how to use digital devices, understanding around data protection, how to share data safely, what can be shared. So we really need to build on that foundation layer across the whole of society. And there's a lot of emphasis on doing that in schools and with students. And then the next layer is around the digital workforce, having the skills that we need to prepare for the future, the kind of digital economy of the future for the UK. And that includes skills like software development, and that's the one that gets a lot of attention. There's also a lot of other skills that are needed by tech professionals around creativity and collaboration, innovation. We don't hear so much about those skills. We see a lot of emphasis on needing people to learn how to code, but those aren't the main skills used in tech. Only a small proportion of the people who work in tech actually write code. So the digital skills gap really represents the fact that we don't have all the skills that we need in the digital space to allow the UK economy to continue to grow in that area. And there's also a digital divide. So people from some backgrounds have far less opportunity to engage with digital devices, learn those kind of digital literacy skills that I mentioned, and to go on to develop the skills needed by the digital workforce. So it is a real issue, and we need everybody to be thinking about how they can upskill and a whole range of skills that are going to help them succeed in jobs of the future. And that's not just jobs in tech, because so many roles rely on a high level of digital literacy and digital skills. Even if your job isn't anything to do with tech, it's often supported and relies on technology.
You've introduced entry-level BA roles and chaired the development of the UK's national BA apprenticeship standard. How does roles contributing to the growth of the tech industry, and what advice would you give to organisations looking to implement similar programmes?
So I would say there's never a good time to start implementing things like apprenticeship schemes and graduate schemes, but you just have to do it. It is so important for tech sector, but also our UK economy, that we have clear pipelines to get people into tech roles. And tech is one of the worst roles for having clear and sustainable pipelines. If you want to be a lawyer or a doctor or lots of other professions, there's really clear pipelines, the things that you know that you have to, and routes that you know how to take to get into those roles. It's very unclear in tech. And we've tried to address that in some respects through the apprenticeships. There's a whole suite of digital apprenticeships which lead to different roles in tech. But we need more organisations to be taking up those kind of roles and introducing graduate schemes and early career roles as well. One of the things that we tend to do in technology is to try to take shortcuts. And one of the ways that we do that is by trying to always hire experienced professionals. You'll see so many job adverts that say 3 to 5 years experience, must have experience of all of these things. But where are people supposed to get that experience from? A lot of organisations are not providing the opportunities for people to get those early career experiences, to get their first job in tech. And that's something that we really need to turn on its head. So about 10 years ago, I spoke at a conference, and the session was called Grow Your Own. And it was about the success that I'd had in my team of creating entry-level roles, recruiting people for aptitude and attitude rather than skills and experience. And that led to my involvement in developing the Business Analysis Apprenticeship. It's one of the digital apprenticeship standards in the UK, and it's really successful. And it also has one of the best gender parity of all of the digital apprenticeships. So that's something that I'm really proud of as well. It's getting more young women into tech.
And talking about championing and building community, oftentimes people are trying to look for a mentor and are trying to build our own community. Do you have any personal experiences or success story from working with a mentor? And how would you recommend any tips for somebody looking for one?
So I think my views on mentorship might be a little bit controversial. I think mentors are sold, particularly to young women, as a silver bullet. Get a mentor that's going to solve all your problems. There's a lot of energy directed into encouraging young women in lots of different professions into getting a mentor. I don't think it's always that effective, and I don't think it's necessarily the right answer for everybody. I think there's lots of people around you that you can learn from and have a really effective and productive working relationship with. If you've got a good relationship with your manager, for example, that can be as or more effective than having a kind of more external relationship with a mentor. So I don't think people should feel under particular pressure to get a mentor if it doesn't seem like it's the sort of thing that suits you, or you can't think of anybody, or you can't find anybody. So don't put yourself under too much pressure. That said, I have had a couple of different mentors in my career, and usually for a fixed period of time. So where I'm going through something particular, I need particular support and guidance and someone to kind of to listen to me and help play back some of the ideas and the things that I'm sharing. So that's something that I found really effective, particularly when I was doing my MSc. And in the last few years, I've also become a qualified mentor and coach. And I think we use the terms coaching and mentoring as one phrase when actually they're two quite separate things. So I think sometimes when people say they need a mentor or they're looking for a mentor, what they actually would benefit from is a coach. So I'd really encourage people to have a look at the difference between those things and think about the situation that you're in and what might be most effective and help you move forward in your career at that point in time.
I'm curious to know, have there been any particular challenges you've encountered, particularly as a woman in STEM, and how did you overcome them? And what changes have you noticed in the tech industry from when you started 20 years ago with regards to women in tech? Quick break. Before we get back to our conversation, I want to remind you to follow, rate, and review the Women in STEM podcast on whatever streaming platform. Your support really helps us to reach more listeners and continue to bring inspiring stories and valuable insight. Don't forget to share this episode with your friends and colleagues who might be interested in learning a bit more about women in STEM. Also, make sure to check out our new LinkedIn page, the Women in STEM podcast, where you get to see some of the latest advancements in technology and learn more about women in STEM. And please make sure to check the bio to see where you can vote for the Women in STEM podcast.
So my journey as a woman in STEM probably started when I chose my A levels, and I was the only girl doing A level physics. So I've been the only girl, the only female in the room for a long time since I was 16 years old. And that hasn't always bothered me. I haven't always noticed, but sometimes I do notice. And particularly when I notice is when I'm in a room full of women. It makes me think, this is unusual. This is not my usual experience. And in fact, a few years ago, I found myself apologizing to a male colleague when I realized he was the only man in a room, in a meeting full of women. And I thought, why am I apologizing? That is the situation that I find myself in all of the time. And it is interesting being a woman in tech. And actually, I was quite resistant to that phrase for a long time. I didn't use that phrase. I didn't engage with women in tech communities. And I think that was for two reasons. One was I didn't see myself as that technical. Despite having a physics degree and having worked my whole career in tech, there's a lot more technical roles within the tech sector. And I thought, well, maybe women in tech spaces are for those women doing more technical roles. And the second thing is, I didn't really want to stand up and kind of remind everybody that I was a woman and that I was worried that there might be some negative associations and negative connotations with me engaging with a community like that. I thought I might be perceived as a bit of a moaning woman. That was my perception from the outside. I did start to engage with women in tech communities, and it has been really valuable for me personally and professionally. That was probably about 5 years ago. I started engaging with women in tech communities and going on to speaking at various events that are aimed at women in tech and particularly young women in tech. So there might be people out there kind of thinking, maybe I don't want to engage with that community. Maybe I don't want woman to be the kind of first part of my identity. I just want to be seen as a professional. And that's definitely how I felt. But I think there is still a lot of work that we need to do in terms of gender parity, particularly in tech and particularly in STEM. So I think engaging with those communities can be really productive, really effective. And I think one of the main things that we can do is be those role models for the tech professionals of the future. So I've done a lot of work with young people and in schools, showing them that a tech professional doesn't look like how they might imagine or how it's portrayed in the media. Lots of different people can succeed and thrive in a career in tech.
Congratulations on your new
Thanks.
book called Careers in Tech, Digital and Data. It aims to highlight a various roles beyond code and to give us a preview. And can you please give us a preview of what the readers can expect and why it's important for us to highlight diverse roles?
Yeah, thank you so much. I've already mentioned that a lot of the get into tech narrative is around learn how to code. And particularly increasing the diversity of the tech workforce is focused on teaching different groups, particularly on women, coding skills and technology skills, which is great. I don't want to detract from that at all. But most people in tech don't write code. So another and perhaps more effective strategy would be for us to highlight the whole range of roles that exist in tech, things like software testing, business analysis, product design, roles that are about collaboration and quality and communication and don't write code at all. If we highlight that range of roles and say to people that whatever your skills and interests, there is a role in tech for you. So don't rule yourself out. Don't assume that you know what a role in tech looks like. So what I've done in the book is taken a whole range of different roles, about 30 or 40 roles in total. I've done a number of interviews with people who are in those roles, from fairly junior roles to very senior roles like Chief Technology Officer and Chief Information Officer, to show people that whole career path in tech that is not really obvious from the outside. And I have talked about some of the benefits and also challenges of a career in tech. I want to paint a really clear picture for people so that they can see themselves, they can understand some of the choices that they might make along the way, and that a career in tech is not linear. You don't kind of start here and end here. A lot of people are now doing squiggly careers or portfolio careers in tech, trying different things, moving sideways rather than always moving upwards. We're not on career ladders anymore. We are really on individually defined career paths where we can try a lot of different roles. And again, I don't think that's obvious to people who are on the outside of the tech sector. We really need the tech workforce to be representative of the population in the UK. We want all of those different diverse perspectives to be feeding into how technology is built and delivered. So to do that, we need the widest range of people to be able to see themselves in that role and consider a role in tech. And so by highlighting all of these different roles available, I really wanted different people to be able to see that there were roles that would appeal to them, whatever their skills and interests.
Looking ahead, what trends do you foresee in the digital and tech landscapes, and how can professionals stay ahead of the changes?
So technology has always evolved really quickly, and so it's always been a key aspect of being a tech professional to be able to keep your skills up to date. And the main way that we can do that is by being curious, being open to learning. And there's so many different ways we can do that. We can learn from our colleagues, we can attend events internally that are about knowledge sharing. We can read books, read articles, attend events, whether that's online, webinars, listen to podcasts, think about all the different options that we have to learn from experts, but also to learn from our peers. And if we have that curiosity, that mindset that's open to learning, then that gives us an edge as tech professionals. It means that we are understanding what skills are going to come along, what new technology is going to come along, and what new roles are going to come along. And that's going to be really important. We're not going to be able to stay in one role or even within one organization for our whole career as tech professionals. We need to be thinking about what's next for me, what skills are going to be more in demand, how can I make sure that I've got those skills and that my CV and my set of skills and experience is as attractive as possible. We're going to continue to see a lot of change in the tech sector, with different roles expanding and others reducing in size. So we need to have that flexible mindset, that idea that, yes, this is what I've trained to do, but I can train to do something else. And we're going to work in so many different roles, certainly more roles than our parents' generation. So that curiosity, openness to learning, and engaging with the professional tech community through events and through networks is so important to stay relevant as a tech professional.
As you reflect on your career, what accomplishments are you most proud of? And what legacy are you hoping to leave in the field of digital leadership?
Thank you. That's such an interesting question. I think the things that I'm most proud of are the routes that I've provided for other people. So you mentioned the business analysis apprenticeship. There are so many people now who have found a great role, a great career path in business analysis through that apprenticeship route that probably would never have discovered it. A lot of business analysts became business analysts by accident. They were something else first and then discovered this role of business analysis. What we're doing with the apprenticeship and also through graduate schemes is making that really clear role much earlier in people's careers and giving people that pathway. So I'm really proud that some of those pathways, particularly the apprenticeship, exists for people to find business analysis. Something else that I'm really proud of is an initiative that I developed last year with a good friend of mine, Adrian Reed. We developed something called BA School Day, which was a global initiative where business analysis professionals could engage with schools, colleges, and universities to share what a business analysis career path looks like and what it involves. We created and shared some resources, and people from all over the world got involved. And we know that we spoke to collectively over 15,000 students globally with different tech professionals, particularly business analysts, going into schools, talking about their job and inspiring a future BA workforce. So that's something that I'm really proud of. We need a more sustainable talent pipeline for lots of tech roles, particularly business analysis, which is what I'm passionate about, but lots of other roles in tech as well. And a way that we can do that and encourage those tech professionals of the future is to get in front of them while they're young, while they're thinking about their choices and their options, and telling them what our roles are like, because the media prevents provides an oversimplified version of what a tech career looks like. And it's our job to set that record straight and to show them that so many different people can work and thrive in a tech career. So that's something that I'm also really passionate about. I've done a lot of work with young people and schools to talk about my career and different career pathways in tech. And I think that's something that all tech professionals should really have on their professional development plan for the year. Like, when am I going to go back into a school environment or inspire young people? That's something that we should all be engaging on a regular basis.
How best can people connect with you, and where can they find your new book?
So I'd be delighted to connect on LinkedIn. That's where I'm most active, Christina Lovelock. I think I'm the only one on LinkedIn, and so hopefully people will be able to find me. The book is available to pre-order on Amazon and also the BCS website, the BCS Bookshop. It's coming out on the 19th of August. And yeah, I'd really love help from everybody to get it into the hands of the right people. So you know somebody who should be interested in a career in tech. They might not be, but you think that they should be. So those are the people whose hands I want to get this book into. And I'm really looking to the tech community to help me to do that.
Listeners, if you've enjoyed this episode, please make sure to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite streaming platform. Leave a review and rating to help us reach more listeners, and follow our social medias, the latest updates and behind the scene content. Join us next week for another exciting episode. And until then, keep exploring the world of STEM and empowering women in STEM.